The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead and this month's guest is a personal favourite of mine. He's Michael Cunningham and he came in to talk about The Hours, his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel based on Virginia Woolf's novel Mrs. Dalloway. Woolf herself makes an appearance in one of three parallel narratives. There is, as Book Club Supremo John Mullen pointed out, a certain audacity in taking on such a canonical writer. His first question, therefore, was, how on earth did you dare?
You know, it was Mrs. Dalloway because I grew up in Los Angeles, and I was not a bookish child. I was in no way precocious. I was a Goomba. I had a Goomba. Oh, Goomba. It's a glamorous American term for a fool. An oaf.
No Goombas in here.
No. It's a Goomba-free environment, I can tell. But what I'm trying to say is I was very regular, and I didn't really read, and I had guy friends and a girlfriend. And it's like the aliens just didn't put the literature chip in my brain. I didn't have it. A girl I had a crush on urged me to read, well, she wanted me to read Eliot and Woolf, because she was reading Eliot and Woolf. Believe me, they weren't teaching Eliot or Woolf in my little suburban high school. And in order to be impressive to this girl, I thought, oh, sure, I'll read Eliot and Woolf, whoever they are. And I went to the school library. The Band-Aid colored trailer on cinder blocks where the books were. and they didn't have any Eliot. They had Mrs. Dalloway. I was the only one who ever checked it out. And I can't even say I read it. I can say that I tried to read it. I couldn't tell what it was about. I couldn't tell what was going on. And yet, I wasn't quite Goomba enough not to see the beauty and grace and muscularity and complexity of those sentences. I'd never seen anything like that before. I didn't know you could do things like that with ink and paper. And I remember thinking, she was doing with language something like what Jimi Hendrix does with a guitar. Like raveling out toward chaos with every sentence and then pulling it back in and finding a sort of unexpected hidden pattern. And I guess you'd have to say that Virginia Woolf was the alien who put the chip in my brain. We use the word life-changing far too often about, you know, those shoes I bought are life-changing. We maybe get one or two actual life-changing events per life. And it's what? I mean, it was revelatory. I mean, I started reading books and eventually started trying to write books. And so Mrs. Dalloway, which is singular to me. I felt like I lost some kind of virginity.
But it's about sort of, I mean, you wrote it, 25 or years or something after that first read? So it's kind of, you must have read it some more, or it must have... Is it a kind of model that was there all the way through the early part of your writing?
You know, I had thought for some time that eventually I wanted to write a book that in some way acknowledged Mrs. Dalloway. I wanted to write a book about reading a book because it was so clear to me that for some of us, reading a book was a visceral and, yes, life-changing experience and was every bit as much a part of your autobiographical material as is your first love, the day your father threw you down the stairs, all the stuff that we novelists are sort of more traditionally expected to draw from. And I kept thinking, I will do this when I feel smart enough and gifted enough. And around my early 40s, I realized I was never going to feel smart enough or gifted enough.
Clever,
so
clever,
I might as well just go ahead.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny, the girl you mentioned, she, I don't know if she, I suspect she must have been conscious of it. I mean, she was recommending maybe the two sort of heroines as writers of the sort of, you know, if you, there's maybe Jane Austen as well, but two of the heroines, and I mean, two novelists who perhaps have the reputation of being writers that, you know, take you into the lives of women, I suppose. And therefore, you know, maybe, I don't know if the girl was deliberately setting you a challenge in that respect, but yeah. I mean, does that, do you think there's any truth in that? I think I remember when I first, was given some Virginia Woolf right at the end of school, and I mean, maybe the sort of the teacher did say something like, "Well, this is brilliant because it's about all this stuff that men ignore, and it's really important, and it's all." I think it was To the Lighthouse, probably. Yeah, so it's all about stuff like what children are thinking, and is the meal nice, and how am I going to die soon, and it's very different, I think I was told by my teacher, from what men write. Do you think that's true of why you found it attractive, or is that that's just
Well, I can certainly tell you that the girl in question, Sue Pender, where are you now? I didn't get anywhere with her, because by the time I could report back on Wolf, she was on to James Joyce, and oh, that hysterical dead housewife is over her. And I was supposed to read Ulysses if I was going to get anywhere, and that was beyond my scope.
It's always another test.
You know, I vacillate on the question of whether there are sort of identifiably male books and female books. I did find, especially when The Hours first came out, that I got a lot of stuff from people about, well, yes, Virginia Woolf was an extremely good writer, but she was no Joyce. And I feel like that is a direct, unambiguous expression of misogyny. That Virginia Woolf wrote books about the epic lives of women, and they are concerned with domestic particulars and are therefore taken by some people, none of my friends, slightly less seriously than the male concerns of James Joyce.
Well, your novel, I mean, reflects that in some quite direct ways, doesn't it? It has three narrative streams, and at the centre of those are three female characters, one of whom is Virginia Woolf herself, and those characters do indeed, in a sort of a way which is reminiscent, deliberately reminiscent of what happens in Mrs. Dalloway, reflect on a mixture of incredibly important, in inverted commas, things, and you know how nice a place setting looks, or how lovely the light is filtered through, that mixture of circumstantiality and domestic observation is obviously something that you really relish.
The Hour started out to be simply a contemporary version of Mrs. Dalloway. And I got into it by about 50 pages and realized, well, that's just a conceit, isn't it? And not a really interesting one. We already have Mrs. Dalloway. Why would we want my version of it? But I don't want to give it up. And I started thinking about, well, what if it involved Virginia Woolf in some way? What if there was this sort of parallel between the character and the woman who, with great nervousness and apprehension, created her all those years ago? And it still wasn't sort of transcending the idea of it. It felt more like an idea than an actual novel. And I was really just about to give it up, because I think any novelist must think this. Sooner or later, you're going to get halfway into a book and realize that there's no book there, and you're going to have to start over. And I was about ready to do that, but, you know, it'd been a year, and I was sitting at my computer sort of thinking about Virginia Woolf. Yes, she was important to me, but what, am I crazy? And I had this sort of image in my mind of Virginia Woolf, and then I sort of saw Mrs. Dalloway standing close to her, and then I saw my mother. And I said, "Mom, what are you doing in my hallucination? Because the third character, Laura Brown, is very much based on my mother. I don't usually do that, but she's very much my mother. And I thought about it, and I realized that my mother, I think, especially in the 50s, 60s, when I grew up, was, she always seemed to me like a sort of Amazon queen, brought with every good intention from where she belonged to an enclosure that was simply too small for her. She was just a bigger, deeper, more intelligent person than the person she was required to be. And her frustration manifested itself as this obsessiveness. I mean, she could spend half a day buying napkins and then come home and think, oh God, I bought the wrong napkins. Why would I think these napkins were any good? At a certain point, germs just stopped coming into the house because they realized there was no point. And it sort of came to me that my mother was seeking a sort of impossible ideal, which is one of my favorite things about the human species, that our ambitions so entirely outstrip our capabilities. And I started thinking, you know, if you remove the product, on one hand, immortal books. On other hand, the desire to create a cake that could eliminate sorrow. One is perishable and insignificant. The other is enormous and hugely significant. But if you take those out, the pursuit is surprisingly similar.
Yeah, yeah.
That desire to make something transcendent, that desire to manifest some divine glory of which you are incapable of producing. And then I felt that my mother, Dorothy Cunningham, was actually entitled to every bit as much attention and entitled to be taken every bit as seriously as Virginia Woolf. And then the book started to click.
Well, her character, or her parallel character, Laura, you do make that sort of perfectionism, that circumstantial perfectionism, into sort of a kind of, you know, observational precision with her. She's always noticing. Well, you as a reader start enjoying her bits because she notices the colours of everything and the shades of everything.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of, it's a sort of appeal in a way to the pleasures of everyday surfaces.
Absolutely. And I am just naturally more interested in characters who have a certain degree of self-awareness.
Yeah.
They're more fun. They're more interesting. There's a tiny little reference, obscure, rightfully obscure to most people, I suspect, to this amazing short story by Doris Lessing called To Room 19.
Oh, I don't know.
It is about an intelligent, fortunate woman who eventually she rents an apartment to be alone in. It's apartment number 19, and she eventually kills herself. And what's so amazing about this story is this woman is entirely capable and smart, and she's not a dupe or a dope. Doris Lessing's not in any way condescend to her, and you follow her right up to the decision to end her life. You think, I get it. I get it. And you can't stand apart from it. You can't say, well, I wouldn't do that because I'm not that stupid. And it's a remarkable accomplishment. Thank you, Doris Lessing, wherever you are.
Well, I was thinking about one of the parallels, one of the many parallels between The Hours and Mrs. Dalloway is that it has a suicide in it. And of course, because it's the Guardian Book Club, everybody's read it. We're allowed to give away anything.
That is a rare experience.
Yeah, no, we're going to talk about the ending in a second. We're allowed to do that, which you can't otherwise do. But I was just thinking one of the most... once you've got the structure and the sort of central characters and, in a way, the rhythm of the sentences, I can see it, the logic of it, absolutely. And there's one bit of the novel which must have been... I don't know if you can remember making the decision to have it, but it seems like a not a necessary decision, and it seems a very important one.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the prologue. The prologue,
yes.
Where, because we have these three We have Virginia Woolf in 1923, living in Richmond, sort of gestating Mrs. Dalloway, suffering from kind of panic, depression. We have Laura Brown, 1949, Los Angeles is kind of rather sort of crispy candy, suburban life, reading Mrs. Dalloway, sort of harbouring, you know, a kid pregnant with the next one, but harbouring sort of suicidal thoughts. And then we have Carissa Vaughan somewhere in the right at the end of the 1990s. But there's one extra bit, which is the prologue, which is set in 1941, and which, you know, it's quite a beginning. It's quite a tough call of a beginning for the writer as well as for the novelist, which is we have Virginia Woolf killing herself. Yeah. And why was that important to have that prologue?
It was originally the last chapter, because the logic of which is obvious. And I looked at it and thought, Virginia Woolf, as we, I'm sure, all know, suffered from periods for which the term depression feels too mild. It's been impossible to sort of psychoanalyze her posthumously. And what she suffered doesn't exactly match any of the clinical diagnoses available now. But she would go way, way, way down. And then would sort of come back again. And one of the things that I so love about her is the fact that it's difficult to imagine anybody better acquainted with how dark and dreadful and intolerable consciousness could be. And yet it would be difficult to name another writer who has written so movingly and convincingly and precisely about the simple pleasures of the world. And if you can't trust Virginia Woolf, who has been to hell and back over and over again, to discourse convincingly on the beauty of an ordinary Tuesday afternoon in Westminster, who can you trust? And I thought, yes, she had these dark periods. Yes, she put a stone in her pocket and walked into the River Ouse, and we think of her as a woman who ended her life. But she also had transcendent moments, which she recorded for us. And I thought, you know what? Let's get the death out of the way early. Let's just let people know that, yes, she did kill herself, but it's not the most important thing to know about her. And it seemed that we should leave her in the novel, not with a stone in her pocket walking into a river, but going on with her life.
Yeah. So I suppose it has the sort of funny, the odd narrative thing. It brings her back to life, doesn't it, the novel? I mean, literally.
Yeah.
It's what you do. I mean, do you, when you were writing it, did you worry about what your reader might or might not know about Mrs. Dalloway in particular and Virginia Woolf in general? Because,
yeah,
of course, I'm reading it as a swotty and rather dusty kind of academic who if they can't remember the bits of Mrs. Dalloway, scutters to the bookshelf to look them up. But I guess, I mean, I don't know, you don't have to fess up to how many copies that the Hours are sold, but wouldn't it be wonderful if all those readers had also read Mrs. Dalloway as well? I mean, did that concern you or not?
Oh, yeah, I find it best to just worry about everything. And yes, it did concern me, but for one thing, neither the author nor his editor nor his agent ever imagined that this book was going to do anything more than sell a couple of thousand copies to librarians and march with whatever dignity it could muster to the remainder tables. Nobody was thinking about what happened. And
you said, I'm doing this novel which is kind of a reworking of Mrs. Dalloway, and they just went, yeah, all right.
Yeah, yeah. Did anyone say, that sounds like a big hit? but, you know, it made me glad for the fact that I have always thought of myself as writing for people who are at least a little bit smarter than I am. And I very much hoped and sort of tried to work it so that the book would make sense if you didn't know Mrs. Dalloway. It will make a different kind of, a deeper kind of sense if you do know Mrs. Dalloway. And the great thing is that when the Hours started to kind of take off, people went in droves to buy copies of Mrs. Dalloway. It was actually
on the bestseller list.
Yes, it was sometimes outselling the hours. This is slightly embarrassing, but I have to say, odd, but there's an edition of Mrs. Dalloway out now that, with a sticker that says, "The book that inspired the hours." Thanks, Virginia.
Well, that's fantastic. I didn't realize that there was that sort of...
It's become a very popular thing, like for book groups, to do Mrs. Dalloway and the hours.
Yeah. And what about, I mean, the other kind of decision, which must have been a sort of almost a moment by moment one, which is that Virginia Woolf, she doesn't. I mean, in a way, her structure is simpler than yours. In some ways, it's one stream, but you do hop into, as it were, different people's minds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And within your three narrative streams, you also do some of that. So most of the time you're with the central character.
Yeah.
You know, but some of the time you're not. So Laura, you get into her little boy's head. In a way, it's very reminiscent, mm-hmm, actually, mm-hmm, to me, of bits of Virginia Woolf, you know, the famous bit at the beginning of To the Lighthouse, where the little boy is actually imagining putting an axe in his father's head because he said he's not going to go on a trip. And how did you decide, I suppose, a crude way of asking it is, did you decide that there were certain characters whose consciousnesses, if only for a little bit, we were going to get,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
some weren't? Mm-hmm. I mean, was that a kind of...
Yeah. There is a sort of penultimate draft, which is fairly different, that much more carefully emulated,
right,
Mrs. Dalloway, and very much included. One of the great things about Mrs. Dalloway is that consciousness is sort of passed like a baton
from character to character.
And if Clarissa Dalloway, who is our sort of main, we're riding the good ship Mrs. Dalloway, but she's walking through a park and she sees a Scottish nursemaid. We're suddenly, or an old Scottish woman, and we're suddenly in that woman's mind for a moment. And then the woman sees a nursemaid, and we're in the nursemaid's mind for a moment, and then we're back, as if we somehow sort of passed something along to each other by seeing each other. And a couple of things. I realized that because there were three stories, the story simply couldn't bear that many. There's always a question of how much a novel can hold, how much it can bear. But I think maybe more important, I realized that another thing that makes me so love Mrs. Dalloway is it has a kind of riffish quality. It was, it's Woolf's fourth book, and I think her first great one, Jacob's Room, is a very, very good book.
Yeah,
but you actually... As you read Mrs. Dalloway, you could actually feel Virginia Woolf coming into her full power by writing Mrs. Dalloway. And it's like a jazz riff played by a genius. And then we go straight to The Lighthouse, which is perfectly symmetrical and perfectly structured for all its kind of beautiful surface randomness. Mrs. Dalloway is her great experiment. In it, we see her becoming the writer she became. And I decided that the thing to try to emulate was not the particulars of Mrs. Dalloway so much as it was that looseness, that kind of, you know, it's jazz. I'm going to write a sonata next, but this is. And so I went back and messed it up, and took out a lot of parallels.
Right. And did you take out some, as it were, characters' thoughts?
Oh, 100 of them. Okay. 100 of them. Yeah, it was really irritating. But, you know, I thought, I so admired it in Mrs. Dalloway, I wanted to do it. No, believe me, the Junk Heap is so full of characters that are no longer in that book.
I mean, it really interests me with novelists who have third-person narratives of any kind, including ones that are much more, in a way, traditional than yours, where and how they choose to enter some minds and not others.
So, right.
You know, like in a detective, last year we had great English, very traditional English detective writer here called P.D. James. You get in lots of her...
Did she sit in the seat?
It's in a different room, actually. And she sort of confessed that if you got in one of her characters' minds, in most of her novels, it meant they weren't the murderer.
Oh, that's
and
good.
And she
to know.
Said at the end that she was going to have to rethink this method because, and so you chose your murderer yeah. from the ones into whose minds you hadn't gone, you know, so it's kind of had real consequences. And I was thinking, I mean, one striking example in The Hours is in the Mrs. Brown section. Now, don't tell me I'm wrong here, because I think I'm not. Obviously, you're in Laura's head. You get into Richie, her son's mm-hmm. head, but you don't get into her husband's
right.
head. And most of her wife's, most of his wife's thoughts about him are kind of quite affectionate thoughts, actually. It's not that you... But there he is, and he comes back in at the end, and he does one rather irritating thing. He blows the candles, he spits on
the cake,
and then she has to kind of repress her irritation at that. And that has quite a big effect. I don't know if he was one of the characters whose thoughts were once there, but that has a big effect on how you sort of feel about that.
Yeah, you know, in the writing of a novel, one... I think must find a balance between calculation and intuition. Too much calculation and it's just a Swiss music box. It doesn't feel alive, and too much intuition, it's just a mess. So there are things in any novel I write that were quite consciously designed and other things that just felt right for reasons I couldn't quite explain. And this is very much of the latter kind. And really, I have to say, it was simply a question of whose minds I felt most interested in entering. There's no larger pattern than that.
To me it makes fantastic sense. It sort of, I suppose, it emphasizes the idea that here unexpectedly is somebody who has in a way an unexpected inner life. She goes off to a hotel room and reads Mrs. Dalloway in L.A. and in the 1940s. And I don't know. It seems to me to emphasise that effect that there's a gap between mm-hmm, her and this guy. Mm-hmm. You know, they sleep together, they go to bed together at the end of the last section about her and him.
Right.
But actually, there is some kind of partition there, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the great things about the sort of intuitive aspect of writing a novel is often the stuff that you did for no reason you could name turns out to be very much a part of the pattern. And I think I probably maybe recognized it on some deep level, but it wasn't conscious. I mean, this is why we still need academics.
Oh, thank God for that. Because we've had a few people who sat in that chair who haven't said that, the last thing you said, which is, they're right, who've said, no, absolutely not. No.
Oh, well, monsters of narcissism. you know, I don't think that the novelist is necessarily the final authority on his novels. I mean, I can tell you things about it that no one else could, but... No. There are things that are there that were invisible to me. Oh,
that's good. Thank goodness. One of the things which I think we talked about it, that binds The Hours to Mrs. Dalloway is that kind of pleasure that the characters take, but in a way you and the reader also take in sort of momentary pleasures, the mm-hmm, moments of mm-hmm, the day. Mm-hmm. One thing that I don't know if it's connected to that, but one thing you do in The Hours which makes it different from Mrs. Dalloway's, very simple thing, which is it's narrated in the present tense.
Yeah.
Did that seem an obvious thing to you, or did you haver about it?
That felt pretty clear early on because, certainly when I added Virginia Woolf and then my poor, thinly disguised mother. Mothers do not raise their children to be novelists. there was a story that took place in the present of the time I was writing the novel, and then two stories that took place in the past. And I'm very much certain that if we delve into the past, if we move from whatever the story's present is, be it the 12th century back to the 10th century, we are writing about different presents, some of which are occurring now and some of which occurred then. And it just seemed most right to write all of them in the present tense, which was a sort of way of reminding the reader that all the stories are equally, right. I hope, equally alive. It's just that some of them are happening in times that are past.
Right. Okay, so it sort of brings them all into the same tense, in a way.
Yeah.
And I mean, is it easier to do that when you also have this thing which you have in a way, I don't know if you've inherited it from Mrs. Dalloway, but which is comparable to Mrs. Dalloway, which is you have the one day sort of frame for each.
Yeah.
This circadian.
Right. No, that it seemed sort of silly to depart from that. That is one of the great glories of Mrs. Dalloway, is what she packs into this assiduously ordinary day.
Yeah, it's an ordinary day though when sort of as in your Clarissa Vaughan's ordinary day, when actually something completely extraordinary happens.
Wolf and I both dropped somebody out of a window.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things that happens to somebody who has read Mrs. Dalloway when they first read The Hours, I think this happened to me when I first read it, is that you kind of fear the worst. You sort of feel that some comparable... I can't remember if I knew what was going to happen, but I knew something was going to.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am sentimental and optimistic, which is hard to admit to, but I am. And although I try to cloak it, and I certainly feel that if you are an essentially sentimental and optimistic individual, your optimism is only going to feel even remotely valid if it can survive the worst that can possibly happen to people. You know, an artist friend of mine actually painted a little thing on our wall back in New York. Once there was a boy and everything turned out all right, the end. And, well, it's nice on the wall. It's exactly what I don't want to do in a novel.
Well, it's funny because of course, in a way, some of the style that it's your own, but it sort of has parallels with Wolf, that you use, it sort of seems designed to kind of mix up, in a way, the grave and the rather delightfully true. I mean, I sort of thought, I can't quote it exactly, but there's a bit I really like when, in the very last section, which is, you know, kind of pretty sad when finally the parallel narratives actually cross and Laura is revealed to be the mother, now aged mother, of Richard, the character who's killed herself, and she's come to the flat, there was going to be this big party. And there's a bit where, as it were, you as the novelist, but Clarissa as the character, can't help noticing all these delicious things described in some detail, all the dishes that are laid out, because she's a bit of a sort of perfect hostess, isn't she?
Yes, yeah.
And it just seems fantastically sort of true to me that at that moment, she can't help noticing the perfect, you know, the particular shade on the chicken skins.
Yeah,
And of course, it's all sitting there for an event which isn't going to happen because of this terrible thing. So, I mean, that is something quite kind of native to Wolf's sort of method of doing things, isn't it? That mixing up.
Yes, absolutely. The I wouldn't say comic. It's not exactly a barrel of laughs, but the quotidian with the tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, she worked such a great balance between people jumping out of windows and a bowl of tulips on the table.
Yeah.
They actually exist in the same universe.
Yeah. And you do the. You must have enjoyed doing the parentheses, the brackets as well.
It was.
Now that was conscious. You knew.
If you pulled all the parentheses out of this book, you could fill it. You could like fill a liter bottle, I think, with parentheses.
Yeah.
Semicolons.
Yeah.
I love it. Semicolons are my favorite punctuation mark. It's a queen of punctuation marks, as far as I'm concerned. as was the M dash, which is a deliciously sort of despicable punctuation mark. What I did was read Wolf, and then put all the books away, and started writing. And did not let myself read a word of Wolf once I started writing my own book, because I wanted to be writing it in my voice, deeply influenced by her voice. I didn't want to try to duplicate her voice. I wanted to sort of strain my voice through hers.
Yeah.
And it did give me a whole new sense of punctuation, which I have carried on.
Yeah.
Have you managed to get? I mean, I can imagine once you get into the sort of drift, the intoxicating drift of the semicolons and parentheses. It must be a hard habit to sort of lose.
Oh, you can go right down with semicolons. like any great pleasure can take you to dark places.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful... Yeah, you won't mind me quoting, right?
No.
Is it the first parenthesis in your whole novel? I'm sure you remember. I'm sure some of them. We should test them, shouldn't we? But it's a really good one because it's about this... The prologue, the bit we talked about where Virginia Woolf is walking to the river to kill herself, and it's 1941, and when I'm reading this, I know what's going to happen. She walks past one of the farm workers, parenthesis. Is his name John?
Right.
Close parenthesis. A robust small... And, I mean, that just seems... that seems very true to actually how she writes, as well as to give one a vivid sense of a character who's somehow in the midst of this absolutely gripping despair, has that classic sort of thing. Because also Virginia Woolf was a bit funny about workers and servants. I can hear her saying that.
She was actually kind of disastrous about workers and servants. there are two unfortunate facts about Woolf. She was a snob and she hated sex. I'm sorry. She more than compensated in other areas.
Yes, they're terrible sins to many contemporaries.
They're big laughs in some circles. I think one of the ways she used the parenthetical that I tried to sort of take for my own was a way of moving between the corporeal world and the inner world. Because of course, one of her great tasks was to write about an ordinary person on an ordinary day to be very much in the consciousness of the various characters and not bore the hell out of readers. I mean, I find few terms as baleful and discouraging as stream of consciousness. Yeah, the last thing I want to read is stream of consciousness.
It does. People, yes. Yeah. It is the kiss of death.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly me. But I think she moved back and forth in a really interesting way that's more complicated and I think conscious than you might understand reading her the first time.
Yeah. It's past time probably when I should give anybody here a chance to ask Michael questions.
Thank you for the book. It did make me run back to Mrs. Dalloway and read it all over again. Do you ever get the temptation of making the character of Richard a woman and possibly towards a more non-death ending?
As a matter of fact, I did. How did you know?
Question.
How did you
see?
Yeah. The book went through many drafts and many permutations. And of course, when you're writing the thing, it takes years, and you're kind of muddling around in your room, and you think, I don't know. Try it this way, try it that way, and there is a draft in which the character of Richard is a figure more like Woolf herself, and then it just didn't feel right, and I gave her a sex change operation. But as to the sort of mortality, no, that was always there because it's Septimus Warren Smith jumping out the window is such a sort of essential part of Mrs. Dalloway that I knew somebody was going to fall out a window.
Hello, thank you. It was very interesting. I haven't quite finished the book yet, but I'm really curious because. I find that in the characters, it's like there are themes is maybe too strong a word. There are kind of echoes among the characters. There's images that appear, there's the ways in which you say things, there's things that they notice or don't notice that you talk about. Like the mirror is a very strong one. Like ideas of kind of luminosity that keep coming through as well. And like the sense of failure, you know, people kind of feeling they're not who they should be. And what I sort of have begun to wonder, without having finished the book yet, was whether you had in your mind, in a way, giving several different voices to Virginia. I mean, I love Virginia Woolf. So, and I just wondered, in a way, if you thought it was almost like letting Virginia live again in several different ways, and if that was something that was going on in the book.
You know, it's certainly true that, in a sense, the three women are different aspects of one character. They're very much meant to be a sort of triple incarnation of the same person who starts with Virginia Woolf. And you know, Woolf was enormously nervous about her work. While Joyce was in Trieste and other places, thinking, work of genius. I am so good. I can't believe how good I am. And turned out he was right. But simultaneously, Virginia Woolf is over there in Hogarth House and other places, thinking, this is shit. This is awful. This is no good at all. And she was wrong. But she did not have brio. She did not have confidence. She suspected she might be brilliant, but she was deeply unsure. So I very much wanted to work with that. There are certain. I actually find that independent of this particular novel, many of us have certain sort of tics. Words were especially devoted to, and I have actually learned, you mentioned this kind of luminosity, which is such a lovely word. I actually have a list of words that I have to go, like find and replace, because there's like 150 of them. Luminosity is one. Light, dark, moment. I keep a list, because I know that something about those particular words is so compelling to me that I will... I put one of them on every third page.
First of all, I want to say what a great joy it is to self-indulge tonight in one of my favourite books.
Oh, thank you.
And I really mean it. I'm not just saying that because you're here and I'm here and we're all here. What I've always felt with this book, because for me, what fascinates me, whether it's art or writing or plays or theatre or music, is anything that challenges the existential, what it feels like to be. Mm-hmm. And the courage to be, for me, is one of life's constant challenges, which I think is what makes The Hours such a special book for me. And there are certain scenes in it which every time I read or see, they touch me at an even deeper level. But I wanted to ask you, for me, when Clarissa collapses in the kitchen, when Richie's ex is there, mm-hmm. she talks about... I think her fear of unravelling, if I remember. I don't think she says fear. I think she just says something, I think I'm unravelling. And I wanted to ask you, Michael, about that, the fear of unravelling and what that means for you in relation to these characters.
Sure. I feel like every novelist, at least the ones I respect, we are all engaged in a sort of doomed... collective effort to write the entire story of the whole world and everything and everyone in it. We will not manage this, but we do our best. And I think each one of us, in his or her way, is telling a part of, you know, the story of the mind of God. And each one of us brings some of what we know in particular to the effort, and I am, why there's no reason to be coy about it, depressive. Always have been. I go on and off medication. When I go off it, I go down. And so the whole notion of facing down hopelessness and having the courage to live, as you say, is simply one of the things that I feel I can bring. Because it better be good for something.
I'm sure some of you have more questions. I'm sorry, but we have to stop it at some stage. And I'd like to thank you all, first of all, for your questions. I was banging on about punctuation, but you've gone to the sort of existential stuff and got, therefore, very interesting, I'm sure you'll agree, answers from Michael, who's been terrifically generous with us. And I'd just like to thank him for coming and talking to us.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.